We suppose a cosmic congratulations is in order. A new planet is being born some 450 light years from Earth. Astronomers are calling it LKCA-15b, and they say it's the youngest planet ever observed at the budding age of around 2 million years old. Adam Krause of the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy was one of the scientists who discovered the planet, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And I gather this is called a protoplanet. It's still being formed. How'd you find it?
So the primary challenge you face is that the light that's coming from a star and from a planet faces a long path to get to us. It passes through the atmosphere, and the motions of air in the atmosphere will tend to smear it out. And then after the light hits our telescope, then even little tiny imperfections in the telescope can also cause the light to bounce around and smear things out. And what we want to do is remove any distortions in the light so that we can identify a faint planet, say, next to a very bright star.
And that's what you were able to do here?
And yes, so the technique we use allows us to identify these distortions and to calibrate those out and to actually subtract them out so that we're left with the light like it appeared when it left that star, rather than passing through our atmosphere and being distorted and smeared away.
So am I right that you ended up finding something that was not very bright at all next to something that was very bright, something very dim that you wouldn't have been able to see otherwise?
Right, right. Without these techniques, then the planet would have been far too faint to observe, considering the resolution and contrast you can normally get just by pointing your telescope at the sky and looking at a star.
And the observatory where you're doing this work is in Hawaii on the top of a volcano, right?
Yes. So the observatory is Tech Observatory, and it's located on top of the Mauna Kea volcano. It's one of the two big volcanoes on the Big Island of Hawaii.
What can you tell us about this planet, besides the fact that it's the youngest one ever discovered?
So the most interesting feature about this planet is that it actually appears that we're not just seeing the planet itself, but we're seeing gas and dust around the planet that appears like it might still be falling onto the planet itself. And so I think the most interesting feature is that it appears to have been caught while it's being formed, not necessarily just while it's young. Based on our observations, it appears that it will continue to be assembled for a while yet into the future. And so we're actually getting a snapshot of planet formation as it's occurring.
And where is it exactly?
The star that it orbits around is, it's in the constellation of Taurus, and it's in one of the nearest regions where stars form. It's about 450 light years away, and it's in a region along with a few hundred young stars that are forming and have been forming over the last few million years, and will probably continue forming for another few million years.
What kind of feeling is that for you as an astronomer to have found this planet?
Well, my first reaction to it was to say, this is great. We'll finally get answers to some of the questions that we've been arguing over for a while. When do planets form? Do they form right after their star, or do they take a few million years in order to gradually assemble themselves? We also want to know, where do planets form? Do they form right next to the star, or do they form sort of in the outskirts of the planetary system that is in the process of forming? And so it was a really great feeling to look at this and realize that we're actually seeing this process in action. And so we're getting direct evidence for how these things really form and how this process operates.
Well, Adam Krause, thanks for telling us about your discovery. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Adam Krause is with the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy. He was one of the scientists who discovered the newly forming planet.
Here's a bleak economic statistic. The nation's student loan debt now exceeds credit card debt. It's climbing toward $1 trillion. Two-thirds of college students graduate with debt, an average of $24,000, but many with far more than that. And as NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, they'll be taking longer than ever to pay back the loans.
Stephanie Ikeni was the first in her family to go to college and did what she needed to pay for it herself.
I was very naive. And I realize that now. But basically, I was just signing papers because the education part meant a lot to me.
The papers were loans, and between her undergrad degree and law school, both at private institutions, Aikini owes about $160,000. She's now 31, living in Altoona, Pennsylvania, and grateful her debt didn't scare away her husband.
He realized what he was taking on, but I don't think he realized the long-term impact, that this wasn't just something that we could pay off in 3 years and be done with it.
About a third of bachelor degree recipients this year have enough debt to have a 20-year longer repayment plan.
Mark Kantrowitz publishes FastWeb.com and FinAid.org, leading websites about paying for college. He says for students who need help, debt's almost unavoidable these days, and yet
nobody is teaching these students how to manage their money. The schools aren't warning them very strenuously about borrowing excessively.
Stephanie Aikini's debt is certainly extreme, and she had no idea what kind of monthly payment it would mean. Turns out it's $1,200. And since she chose nonprofit work over the law, that's more than half her take-home pay.
Basically, all of our financial decisions are made based on his salary alone.
Decisions like buying a house and even having children. That doesn't seem possible for now, maybe ever, as Aikini and her husband have explained to family.
It's not what they like to hear. And, you know, we get the pep talk. Well, you guys can make it work. And I know everyone says that they don't know how they're going to afford children, but we really don't.
Aikini says it weighs on her conscience that she's not the only one constrained by her debt.
It's hard every month when we're paying bills. And my husband pays all of them. All right, now I'm getting emotional because, you know, he has dreams that he wants to fulfill and he really has to put them on the back burner because there's not much else I'm able to contribute.
I can't lie. I often fantasize about just like fleeing the country and being a debt fugitive in Canada or Europe or somewhere.
Annie Spencer was also the first in her family to go to college, a small state school, then private grad school. She saw higher education as a way out of the precarious paycheck-to-paycheck existence she'd grown up in. So, despite merit scholarships and working 30 hours a week, she racked up $85,000 in student loan debt.
From the minute I graduated from my master's degree, my job prospects were completely limited to the jobs that would help me pay back my loans.
She gave up on social justice work and landed a decent-paying government job. But in New York City, with high rent plus $600 a month in loan payments, it was tough.
There were months when, you know, I was really having to watch my budget in terms of grocery shopping.
Spencer's boyfriend also has substantial student loan debt, and she says this burden hangs over any future she tries to imagine for the two of them. Unlike most other debt, even if you declare bankruptcy, says aid expert Kantrowitz, student loan debt does not disappear.
Education debt has often been highlighted as good debt because it's an investment in your future. But too much of a good thing can be harmful.
Last year, Annie Spencer's student loan debt helped push her into an unlikely course, back to school for a PhD. No loans this time. She's on a teaching fellowship. But Spencer figures if she's always going to be strapped for money, she might as well feel good about her career. And it lets her defer those loans.
And honestly, it was just becoming such a day-to-day stress. So being back in school kind of gave me a chance to stop the clock.
A chance, she says, to figure out a better strategy to pay down her crushing debt. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
In the space of just a few weeks, Hollywood will give us four serious dramas about mentally unstable characters. This mini-trend is probably coincidental, but our critic Bob Mondello says it got him thinking about narrative form.
Curtis, a construction worker in the drama Take Shelter, is worried that he might be losing his mind. He has premonitions of violent storms, of rain as thick and brown as motor oil. At work, he sees flocks of birds soaring in strange patterns.
You ever see birds fly like that? What?
Curtis is aware he might be delusional, but that doesn't really help. He can never quite be sure what's real and what isn't. And in Take Shelter, neither can the audience, unless the director cues us by, say, having Curtis wake up abruptly.
Ah!
Michael Shannon's Curtis is hardly the only anxious character at the multiplex. Ellen Barkin's latest picture casts her as a famous actress consumed by delusions. Elizabeth Olsen's teenager in Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene does not have the multiple personalities those many names suggest, but she does have so little sense of self that she's losing her grip on reality. And the film that won Kirsten Dunst a Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival, Melancholia, is centrally about depression.
The earth is evil. We don't need to grieve for it. Nobody will miss it.
Melancholia, in this case, is big enough to swallow an entire planet. What these characters have in common is narratives that often feel as fractured as their own sense of reality. Their directors mess with imagery and time and story structure to throw the audience off balance, to make our nerve endings as raw as those of the characters.
Feel the tension leaving your stomach and moving to your hands. Think of someone who hurt you, who lied to you. Feel it. Let it transfer to the gun. Release.
This current crop of neurotics joins an asylum's worth of troubled Tinseltowners we've been asked to identify with: the disturbed ballerina in Black Swan, the schizophrenic mathematician in A Beautiful Mind, the giant rabbit-obsessed teenager in Donnie Darko, all the way back to Jimmy Stewart's acrophobic private investigator in Vertigo. Hitchcock experimented on occasion with splintering narrative to put you inside the head of a disoriented character. But there's now a whole cinematic vocabulary directors can play with: leaps in time and mood communicated by skewed camera angles, shifting sound quality, the alternating of black and white with color. In Memento, which used all those devices and more, a guy who can't form short-term memories has his story told backwards, so the audience will be as clueless when he meets someone as he is.
If I seem a little strange or rude or something, I've told you this before, haven't I?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to mess with you, but it's so weird. You don't remember me at all.
No.
Not every filmmaker decides to shred the plot when a main character's synapses start misfiring. Think One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or King of Hearts, comparatively conventional portraits of neurosis where the inmates of the asylum prove saner than their keepers. Or The Madness of King George, where audiences are asked to share the distress of the royal court as its monarch deteriorates. Those films, of course, spring from an assumption that stable is normal, that feeling uneasy is not. What's intriguing about this month's pictures is that they seem to spring from a sense that anxiety is the new normal, that there are reasons for characters who are not in horror films to feel threatened and disoriented: the economy, job loss, political uncertainty, and, yes, mental illness. So the characters do exactly what you want them to do. They see therapists. They try to work through their issues. And does that help? In Melancholia, Kirsten Dunst plays a severely depressed woman who understands precisely how out of step she is. She recognizes her delusions, a forest of vines, say, tugging at her wedding dress, as delusional. Doesn't mean she's wrong, though. She's been saying most of her life that the world is going to hell. And through her eyes, and then through our own, we see that it is. I'm Bob Mandello.
Gap is one of America's biggest clothing retailers, and the company recently announced plans to shut down 20% of its stores. It's not alone. The bad economy has hurt many clothing companies. But a Japanese retailer is moving ahead with plans to open hundreds of American stores. Reporter Ashley Milne-Tight reports on how Uniqlo is defying the economic trends.
3, 2, 1... cut.
That's the CEO of a Japanese company, Fast Retailing. It's the parent company of Uniqlo. The executive was in New York last week to cut the ribbon at a cavernous new flagship store on New York's glitzy Fifth Avenue. Uniqlo is sort of like the Gap of Japan. The low-priced casual clothing retailer has been around since the 1980s, but sales are flattening out in its home market, so the company's looking overseas for growth. The U.S. is at the heart of its strategy, according to the head of Uniqlo's U.S. operation, Shin Odake.
If you are to be recognized as global brand, we need to have a huge store in center of New York City.
Uniqlo has had a store in downtown Manhattan for several years. It's been a hit with shoppers, and the company wanted to build on its success. In addition to the Fifth Avenue store, it's opening another today on 34th Street, just down the block from Macy's. Both stores are three stories high and piled floor to ceiling with cashmere sweaters in every imaginable color, three shades of green and blues from navy to periwinkle. They're on sale for $50 and $60. Fashion consultant Roseanne Morrison with the Doniger Group says that range of colors lures consumers into buying more than one item.
Especially when the value is good. They think, okay, I'll buy two for me, but, you know, I think I'd like to get this new color for my husband. And that's really the secret.
Just before opening day at the 34th Street store, hundreds of employees are scurrying about unpacking jeans, on sale for $9.90 a pair. They're setting up displays, and checkout staff are lined up behind their cash registers practicing their friendliness and timeliness. Then they each race to fold the clothes perfectly.
Remember to put your shirts on top. Okay.
Attention to detail is one of the things the company hopes will differentiate Uniqlo from its rivals like H&M and Gap. Odake says another is innovation. He says the company studies its clothing with the eyes of an engineer.
We approach basic product and we try to improve it every year. Similar to the car manufacturer, try to improve the make of the car. So that's the approach that we have, which is quite different from, I think, the other brands.
That Japanese engineering is what brought shopper Ermi Chan, who's visiting from Toronto, to Uniqlo's Fifth Avenue store. She's just loaded up on one of the company's signature products, its so-called heat tech clothing, innovative thermal underwear.
Owned it for years, have to keep buying it because my sister and my family will steal it.
Chan says she likes the quality and value here compared to similar stores. Retail consultant Patricia Powell says that combination could give Uniqlo an edge in a lousy economy.
Fundamentally, you know, we are a nation that is born to shop. You can only restrain yourself for so long. People are going to buy things that are of good value. They're not going to buy things just because they're cheap.
Uniqlo's U.S. CEO Shin Odake says he eventually wants to have 1,600 stores in this country, almost twice the number of Uniqlo outlets in Japan. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite in New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Israeli writer Amos Oz has crafted a book of connected short stories that are all set in the fictional village of Tel Ilan. Scenes from village life is almost a novella. In these stories, the mundane routines of village life belie all sorts of fractured lives. The mayor's wife has left him with a note and no clue as to where she's gone. The doctor's nephew was not on the bus she expected him to be on. An old Labour Party politician rants about former colleagues and rivals who sold out the cause and complains of a mysterious digging sound under the house. Amos Oz joins us now from Tel Aviv. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you.
In these stories of the village of Tel Ilan, nothing ever seems to be satisfactorily resolved. People are lost, they're not found, a strange intruder manages to intrude. Why is life in this fictional, picturesque Israeli town so unsettled?
These are stories about people who have lost something, or rather, hid something from themselves, and they are searching for the loss in the attics, in the basements, everywhere and all the time, not finding it because this is the human condition. Most of the time we hid something from ourselves and we don't really find it.
Your publisher says you've written a parable of modern Israeli life. Have you, or is it something more universal than that?
No, I think it's more about human condition than about the Israeli condition. It's about love and loss and loneliness and longing. It's about death and desire. It's about desolation and disillusionment. The basic things, the simple and great things.
Now, at the end of Scenes from Village Life, after this realistic description, these short stories, you add a very dystopian kind of postscript. Suddenly you're writing about a place of poisonous vapors and putrefaction. A healthy, handsome stranger arrives at the village and the women say we must kill him. What's going on at the end?
It's a nightmare that I had some 6 or 7 years ago, and I wrote it just as I had it. It's not an allegorical story, nor is it a disguised statement about anything. It's just a rendering of a nightmare.
a nightmare that could well have been in the same fictional village that you're writing about?
Not necessarily. It's called in a different time and in a different place, in another place and in a different time. So it's not necessarily the same village. But because it is a village nightmare, I found it right to include it in this collection of stories, or rather novel in stories.
So I want to ask you something. I want you to explain something about Israel, real-life Israel of the news that we read about in the news, and Tel Ilan, your village of fiction. This week, after 5.5 years of being held hostage in Gaza, Gilad Shalit was released. The country agreed to free more than 1,000 prisoners to bring him home, and Israel rejoiced like a big village. It was the very sort of happy ending that your characters never get.
Yes, it was a happy ending at a very heavy cost, because for the release of Gilad Shalit, Israel had to release more than 1,000 terrorists, convicted terrorists, including some mass murderers. So this was a big drama, and the Israelis responded like one big happy family to the release of Gilad Shalit. But I'm not about writing happy endings. I think stories with happy endings occur very scarcely. And I think the story of Gilad Shalit with a happy ending is a happy ending for Gilad Shalit, not necessarily a happy ending for the bereaved families of the victims of those mass murderers.
Are you confident about things in Israel nowadays, or does it worry you? Do you have nightmares about what the future might be for the country?
I'm worried about the future. I'm always worried about the future. I think every Israeli is worried about the future. And yet, deep down below, I believe that in the end of the day, there will be an historical compromise between Israelis and Palestinians, simply because there is no alternative to such a compromise. There will be a state of Israel next door to the state of Palestine, not at love, but in peace and coexistence, simply because the Palestinians are not going anywhere and the Israelis are not going anywhere. They will have to divide the land, to divide the house into two smaller apartments. I think it's called in English a semi-detached house. And I think this solution is impending. I can't tell you how soon. I'm not a prophet. But I think this solution is impending.
But you know, I think the other time when I interviewed you, a novel had just come out in English, but it was in the early days of the Oslo process. And you were pretty upbeat then, too, and felt that we should understand this not as a marriage between two peoples, but as the divorce through which Palestinians and Israelis would disengage from one another's lives. Hasn't been a very encouraging couple of decades since then.
Well, in the Middle East, when people say never or forever or for the rest of eternity, they usually mean something between 3 years and 30 years. I have traveled to Egypt with an Egyptian visa stamped in my Israeli passport. I have traveled to Jordan with a Jordanian visa stamped in my Israeli passport. This is much more than I would have dreamt of 30 or 40 years ago. So things are changing in the Middle East. And I believe that despite all the obstacles created by fanatics on both sides, there will, at the end of the day, be an historical compromise.
And you're telling us, against the grain of much supposed conventional wisdom, in the Middle East, forever is actually a very short time.
Forever is very short time, and that's why when the leaders, the fanatical leaders of the Arabs and of the Israelis, vow that they will never make this concession or never recognize Israel or never give up East Jerusalem, I am very suspicious about the length of those nevers.
Well, Amos Oz, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Thank you for your good questions. Thank you very much.
Mr. Oz spoke to us from Tel Aviv. His new book, which he calls a novel in stories, is called Scenes from Village Life.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week.
Hi, Ira.
Seasonal,
less controversial than our last topic, because this week's video pick is about pumpkins.
Pumpkins. How could you not like a pumpkin?
I know.
How could it be controversial, a pumpkin?
Well, I don't know if it can be controversial, but these actually are no ordinary pumpkins. This is not your sort of typical jack-o'-lantern. We are talking jack-o'-lantern 2.0, designer pumpkins, call them what you will. These are really fancy pumpkins. We went and talked to master carvers. They're these two guys. They're living they're working in Bushwick in Brooklyn, and in their basement they have 50 pumpkins. They're carving hundreds of pumpkins every fall, and they end up as works of art.
Yeah, and they gave you some hints about how to carve a pumpkin, what to do the right way.
Yes. So there are a few things that we learned that I thought that kind of, you know, blew my pumpkin out of the water. A lot of things that I took for granted in carving.
Such as?
For example, when you're scooping it out, don't carve off the stem. Why? Because apparently the stem is providing the pumpkin some nutrients. So if you actually carve that hole where you're going to scoop out the seeds and stuff from the back, your pumpkin will last longer.
Hmm.
So they don't carve the stem.
Don't get rid of this. And don't pick it up by the stem so it breaks off, right?
Another tip. They said they see it all the time, people picking it up by the stem. Don't do that.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Here with Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, talking about our new video pick of the week. It's up on our website. Gorgeous pumpkin carving. It's artwork, really.
It really
science
is
and art on this one.
It really is science and art. I mean, there are portraits. They have a very spectacular Michael Jackson portrait on one of the pumpkins that you can check out on the video.
And they have Michael Jackson. They have a special one related to the program.
And if that's not enough, they even have a Science Friday pumpkin there for us that they carved on the spot. So let me give you some more tips,
okay?
Because, you know, people
are
getting ready.
This is the season.
So one thing that they do, they don't really carve through the pumpkin. They etch, actually, and they keep the pulp there. So they carve first, they sort of etch it out, and it's going to be the photo negative, right, or the negative of this. So where they go deeper, it will be brighter. And one thing that they do is they carve first and then they scoop, and this is sort of another prolonging the lifespan. But this was my favorite tip. This is one that you can do after you've carved the pumpkin.
There's little tricks that you can do to rejuvenate your pumpkin too. You know, sometimes if you're making a salad and you have some limp lettuce or something in the fridge, you can shock it in some ice water. You can do that with a pumpkin. If it's starting to look a little sad, you fill a big bucket or tub with water and ice and plunge the pumpkin in there. If you leave it in there for a few hours, it'll really perk back up, and it's kind of awesome.
That was Mark from Maniac Pumpkin Carvers. He's one of the founders along with Chris. So I never knew that.
No.
Not that, I mean, most people feel that strongly about keeping their pumpkins.
Right. What do they say? What kind of light? You know, people put candles in there. They put light bulbs. What's the best thing?
This is truly a geek moment. They use candelabra CFLs. There's actually a wire coming out of the back of the pumpkin. And this gives them not only more light, but they've tried incandescents. And they said that when they put the incandescent in, it got really hot. And so it would start to smell like pumpkin pie, which was pleasant. But the pumpkins would just dissolve after a few days.
Very Benji. Very, very, very
Benji. Well, that's a word that, in case people aren't catching that, that's a word we've coined on Science Friday for geek.
Yes. Much better
Benjamin
than
Franklin.
Yes.
So it's very Benji.
And so they gave you more hints? Any more hints?
Any more hints. One thing they do is they seal their pumpkins with Vaseline. I mean, this is really taking it to the next
level. This is geek. This is pumpkin geek, serious geek stuff.
And the reason that this has become important to them is because these pumpkins aren't cheap. I mean, each pumpkin is a couple $100, and so they don't really end up on the stoop usually. They're in advertisements. Tiffany's did an ad with a $3 million diamond in one of their pumpkins.
Whoa.
I know.
Hope they took the seeds out.
High low, you know, it's very in. And they end up in Yankee Stadium and on album covers. So these are, you know, not your sort of typical thing. But I'm excited to go home and carve.
Yeah. And you watch them. If you want to see our video pick of the week, you want to see how these pumpkins are carved and what to do to prepare it, keep it fresh.
Give it a bath. That's another tip.
You need to wash it, right?
Because it could get infected, just like if you're doing surgery on anything. You want to clean it first.
That's right. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. You guys laugh now, but you laugh even more when you see this video
<right. laughs>
at Science Friday.
The laughing has just begun.
And it's funny, but it's also very geeky and very interesting. And it's so gorgeous. The artistry in this is amazing.
No, I mean, we should say, when I saw this, I was blown away. I definitely wasn't. I think what they do is really amazing. These guys are professional illustrators who basically turn their medium to pumpkin when October rolls around. And they do this mostly because they want to have an artistic project. It doesn't sound like they're, you know, making huge bucks.
And the photo, if you're on Facebook, it's Sci-Fi Facebook page, you can also see the photo up there of the pumpkin and special added photo of yours truly on the pumpkin coming up on the website. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week. Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and spinning the dials here in New York. If you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. You can take that pumpkin podcast and put it on your iTunes. In audio and video, and also we have an Android app. You can take it along with you. Watch it anytime you'd like to. Yeah, it's kind of cool. You can also go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can watch the video there also. And join our community all week on Facebook and become part of that community and sign up for that also. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.